I think the first question here today is why Donald Trump Jr. even released all of these without doing a little more vetting. They're prioritizing the media campaign, and I don't think they're thinking about the legal circumstances that they're in. And I think that that's one question that gets raised by the release of this whole raft of emails. I think the second thing is they are certainly in legal consequence now, and these emails establish a point in time when they appeared to be possibly openly colluding with Russian operatives. Did the president know about it? Did other people in the administration know about it or in the campaign? These are all questions that are raised by these emails.
Snap shares getting whacked Tuesday, trading below their $17 IPO price. Morgan Stanley, the lead banker on the IPO, taking the rare step of trashing a stock it brought to market, cutting its rating on the stock, saying, quote, "We have been wrong about Snap's ability to innovate and improve its ad product this year."
The U.S. Secretary of State has begun his four-day trip to the Gulf. The aim, to find a breakthrough in the Qatar crisis. Four countries in the region have cut diplomatic and transport links with the tiny state, accusing Qatar of financing extremist groups, something it denies, and siding with Iran, their arch foe. Rex Tillerson's senior advisor said he'd use the trip to explore ways to end a stalemate in discussions. That after Qatar rejected 13 demands that Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain and Egypt issued as conditions for ending their sanctions.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Wednesday. It's July 12, 2017. Glad you're here for another edition of The Opening Bell, another business day underway, and lots coming up here on the show. A little bit later on, have you ever thought about living in a tiny home? Maybe you've seen one of them on the History Channel or one of the other reality shows. It's a movement or a fad. We'll talk to one of the builders of tiny homes and what all of this is about a little later in the program. We'll bring in Dale Buss, too, in a moment to talk autos. But first, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, we're looking for a positive open on Wall Street later this morning. Dow futures are up 23. The NASDAQ futures up 8. S&P futures are up about 3 points this morning. In Asia this morning, mixed numbers. The Nikkei off about a half a percent. The Hang Seng is up, though, about a half a percent. In Europe this morning, lots of green arrows. The FTSE, DAX, and CAC are all higher, all by about a percent. The DAX is up about 87 points right now. The FTSE is up about 68 points. Back in this country, around the world, gold and silver are trading higher. Oil is trading higher, too, about a percent and a half. $45.79 a barrel. Some stories that we're watching for you. The dollar has struck been stuck near its lowest level in more than a year against the euro, while stocks are edging higher around the globe in light trade, all ahead of Janet Yellen's testimony to Congress. So she will begin, the Fed chair will begin her testimony later on today, and expected to say that the Fed remains on a hawkish course of steadily rising rates. Any signals on how the bank is viewing a retreat in inflation and muted wage growth will be closely watched. Again, she will speak to Congress starting today. Other stories, Microsoft announcing a project to bring broadband internet access to rural parts of the United States, including Wisconsin. The company based in Redmond, Washington, is calling for a combination of private and public investments to get about 2 million rural Americans online over the next 5 years. A huge railroad and transit project to build a new bridge and tunnel capacity for travel between New York and New Jersey could receive $900 million next year if a senior New Jersey Republican has his way. This could be one of the first big infrastructure projects around the country under the Trump administration. Also this morning, Republican lawmakers have overturned more than a dozen regulations issued under President Obama. Now they're looking to do the same to a rule issued Monday that would let consumers band together to sue banks or credit card companies rather than use a mediator to resolve a dispute. The effort would be a first for this Republican-led Congress overturning a rule issued during the presidency of Donald Trump. Well, auto sales have taken a turn for the worst as we begin the middle of the year here. It's been sort of a rough year for the industry so far, turning a tide that was seeing some really good sales over recent years. Let's bring in Dale Buss. He's a contributor at Forbes Chief Executive Magazine, focuses on business and autos specifically from Michigan this morning. Good morning, Dale.
Good morning, Steve.
Glad to have you with us again. So talk to us about this. We've seen all kinds of different reports about how all of the arrows in the auto industry are pointing down. How bad is it?
Well, it's not maybe as bad as it might seem. What's bad, essentially, are sales of cars as differentiated from SUVs and trucks. I mean, if you look at particularly, say, the big three, the traditional Detroit three, there's a study out showing that car sales by Fiat Chrysler have fallen by 24% in the last year or so, and Ford by 20%, GM by 19%. And that's resulted in, you know, layoffs and production cutbacks at General Motors especially. It's also meant that Ford, for example, if you remember the dust up from the Trump campaign trying to decide what to do about manufacturing their small Focus car that was going to go to Mexico, and then Trump complained, now it's going to go to China. Well, it really doesn't even matter because Ford isn't selling that many Focuses anymore. So that all is bad for the industry. But what's happened is sales of light trucks and SUVs, pickup trucks and SUVs, have continued to expand dramatically. And now they account for about almost two-thirds of the industry. And that's where companies make their biggest profits. So while car sales are down because the gasoline prices are down and just people have switched to SUVs, the sales of SUVs and trucks have helped the company's profitability. So it's not all gloom and doom, but, you know, the industry has fallen off a peak of after a seven-year surge in sales. So, you know, people are concerned.
You know, the part of it, you mentioned the layoffs. We've sort of put a little list together here of the ones that at least we've been reporting on. Ford seems to have the most of those layoffs in terms of, you know, numbers, 20,000 of them. What is the significance of those and those shifts? I know some shifts have been canceled at some plants. Is that a significant part of this as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the industry, say, 5, 6, 7 years ago, coming out of the Great Recession, the big accomplishment of the industry was not only to survive, although with certainly with taxpayer help, but to make the transition to smaller, more fuel efficient vehicles, especially cars. I mean, the whole fleet is getting more fuel efficient, but back in 2008, when gas prices reached $4 a gallon, I mean, Ford had a whole fleet of new cars, you know, Focus, Fiesta, Fusion, the F cars, all small cars that were absolutely perfect for meeting that challenge. Well, everything's changed since then. Gas prices have stayed pretty quiet, very reasonable, especially in historical terms. And consumers have said, hey, you know, I can still get good gas mileage in, say, a compact SUV. I don't need a car. Millennials especially are not really fond of the traditional sedan styling. And so, you know, every company is getting hurt, but a company like Ford that made huge investments in that small car fleet is getting hurt especially. And Fiat Chrysler has given up on small car production almost entirely. They've stopped making the Chrysler 200 and the Dodge Dart. And they said, we're just going to do Jeeps and trucks.
Dale, hang on with us. We'll continue our conversation with Dale Buss here from Michigan this morning, talking about the auto slowdown.
From ABC News, Wall Street Now, investors left the markets essentially the way they found them yesterday, with only a half-point gain for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. The S&P 500 lost just under 2 points. The NASDAQ picked up 17 to close at 61.93. Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen heads to Capitol Hill to address the House Financial Services Committee. She'll answer lawmakers' questions on the Fed's plans to raise interest rates and to unwind assets. As if its bankruptcy filing weren't enough, Takata Corporation has added another 2.5 million vehicles to the largest automotive recall in U.S. history. The airbag inflators in some Fords, Nissans, and Mazdas, previously thought to be safe, have now been called back for replacement. And the world's largest app-based ride-hailing service apparently has weathered a series of scandals in recent months, including the ouster of the man who founded the company. Uber has told investors that bookings for rides were up 10% last quarter. Jim Ryan, ABC News.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. 522 DL Butts is with us this morning from Michigan talking about auto slowdown. DL, we mentioned some of the car companies that you mentioned, Fiat, who's sort of just pulled back completely. But I know one of your articles this week talked about how Mazda is dealing with this climate recently. They're doing some unique things.
Yeah, I mean, Mazda's interesting. They're a tiny player in the U.S. market. They're actually number 12, but they're definitely punching above their weight. And what they're trying to do is premiumize their brand and their lineup by offering features that people, you know, might expect in a more expensive automobile, maybe an Acura or an Infiniti, at more reasonable prices. And they've done pretty well in raising their image from the old kind of zoom days, where what you thought of a Mazda was, you know, an inexpensive little runabout car. They've done a pretty good job of kind of changing that image. And also, Mazda is doing a little bit better than the rest of the industry, in part because while they have a small or a short roster of vehicles, they're pretty well balanced between small cars and SUVs. They've got three different SUVs and crossovers to offer the American public. And, you know, let's contrast Mazda, say, with Hyundai, which used to be a small player in the U.S. market. Now it's pretty significant. But their sales are down, I think, by more than 7% so far this year because Hyundai, a Korean company, just didn't do a good job several years ago of anticipating the shift in the U.S. market to SUVs. And so their fleet was, you know, pretty well concentrated in those small cars that we've been talking about. And they've missed an opportunity for, you know, thousands and thousands of sales in the U.S.
How do the other car companies deal with this? Are we going to see more deals at the dealerships, or are they just going to take these hits on the chin?
Yeah. No, we're definitely seeing more deals. Over the last really 2 years, the level of financial incentives, rebates, and so on available at dealerships has definitely increased. And that's, you know, kind of a sort of a classic reaction of the auto industry. When times get tough, you make deals easier. You know, the challenge there is traditionally the industry has just said, well, when times are tough, to avoid shutting down factories, even for a short time, which is very expensive, we'll just offer more and more rebates. Well, then over time, the brands get eroded. People start to think they can get deals all the time, and it just kind of affects the industry in a very bad way over the long term. So all of the companies have been trying to do a better job of holding the line on incentives, you know, and not overproducing. And that's why you have some of the layoffs, especially in production of car-type vehicles that we've been talking about. And just interesting, one other note, over the longer term, you know, the industry is concerned about ever reaching perhaps the peak that they reached last year of over 17 million vehicles a year sold. And they're concerned about millennials. You know, are they going to purchase vehicles at the same kind of rate and in the same kind of way that, you know, their parents did, for example, the baby boomers? You know, so far they're concerned that maybe that's not the case. But millennials just seem to be doing the same things previous generations did just a little bit later. So there is hope recently over the last couple of years that shows that millennials are sort of coming to the car market just a little bit later than previous generations. And, you know, so maybe millennials themselves will be interested in vehicles. You know, the question is, will they be sharing them, you know, via Uber, for example, or will they actually be buying them?
If the slowdown generally continues or gets worse, how could this possibly impact related industries?
Well, the auto industry is huge. There's still nothing bigger than auto production in the U.S. economy, you know, despite our shift to services and that kind of thing, and obviously despite the huge role of tech. You know, if things continue to slide, it won't be good, especially for the industrial Midwest and the Mid-South, the South, Southeast, where, you know, all auto production pretty much is. And it's going to undermine, you know, what the Trump administration has been, you know, trying to do with the bully pulpit by getting auto manufacturers to commit to U.S. jobs. So it'll be interesting going ahead to see if these indications of maybe a little bit stronger economic growth overall in the U.S. are able to sort of support or keep auto sales, you know, at or near these record levels that they've been at the last few years.
All right, Dale. Good chatting with you as always, and thanks for being with us this morning.
All right. Thank you, Steve.
Dale Buss with us from Michigan this morning. By the way, you can read Dale's latest article at Forbes.com on Mazda. We're going to link out to that as well. You can follow him, too, on Twitter at DLDBuss.
From ABC News, Tech Trends.
The sharks have smelt the blood in the water. They're circling. It's time to prepare.
How safe is your smart home? Smart doorbells, thermostats, a coffee pot, even a hairbrush. 21 billion connected devices worldwide expected by 2020. The Kandel family says they have four smart home devices with plans to add more.
I also get alerted when my garage door opens.
Could somebody potentially get into our computer, to our bank accounts?
So armed with only a laptop, security expert James Lyon set up shop in the family's backyard, and within 2 minutes, he'd compromised the network.
And we're into the DVR. Now, we have a computer sitting inside the network that we can use to attack other things.
So what should you do to protect yourself? Well, James says keeping those vulnerable devices up to date is crucial.
Treat it like a computer. Update it, keep it on the latest version, make sure you have a non-default secure password for these devices.
With Tech Trends, I'm Daria Albinger, ABC News.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. It's 538. Glad you're here with us for our Wednesday edition of the show. You've probably seen one of the shows on reality television, the tiny homes movement. Tiny houses, tiny homes have become popular alternatives to high-priced living. And for people who may want to have a little bit of luxury living on the road or even just small living in their life, we thought we would talk about this today and bring in one of the builders of these homes from Titan Tiny Home. And Bob Clarizio is the president of the company. He's with us this morning. Bob, good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to The Opening Bell. We are going to put some of the pictures from your company out on our Twitter feed this morning, but give us a sense of whether this is a movement, a fad. How would you describe this tiny home situation?
I would I'd say it's, well, some of my customers would call it a retaliation, but the big thing is definitely, I think a lot of people confuse the tiny house movement just strictly with frugality, but the reality of the situation is outside of just saving some money, the condensing of the amount of kind of stuff we have in our life is really fueling a lot of people to go this direction.
Give us a sense, too, of when we talk about a tiny home, what are the sizes that we're talking about? Because I've seen everything from something that looks like a doghouse being pulled from the back of a truck to really nice homes that you build for folks that are not really that tiny, but they're smaller. What are the general dimensions that qualify for a tiny home?
So there's all sorts of stuff. I mean, typically we build what's called a tiny house on wheels, and they're about 8.5 feet wide, and they range between 20 feet and about 32 feet long. So they really fit the overall footprint of an RV travel trailer. They're very versatile. They can be moved at any moment across the country without any special moving permits and so forth. The only difference is that they're a little taller than an RV trailer, as they stand about as high as a semi-truck trailer. So that gives you a kind of an idea. They average in size from 160 square feet all the way up to 350. One of the other things that's really interesting is we're getting into other types of tiny houses as well. Just last night, and I don't know if I'm allowed to disclose where I was, but you can check out my Instagram, and I think we tagged ourselves there. But we're talking about tiny houseboats in a marina outside of us, of Ottawa, Illinois.
Okay.
So we're doing all sorts of different things. It's just a matter of what you want to classify us as.
Well, and you can also visit your website there, TitanTinyHomes.com, and see some more pictures about this. So Bob, tell us, if we're thinking about doing this, what should be the number one consideration of switching to a tiny home?
I think one of the biggest things that people get kind of concerned about is what kind of truck and all that stuff that they need to pull the unit with. And the reality is that you're not going to move a whole lot throughout the year, not as much as that somebody might think. So, you know, moving and shipping companies and stuff like that are rather affordable. So I wouldn't concern myself so much with the truck. That's a big, obvious one that a lot of people think they need to deal with. The biggest thing I would deal with is your stuff, you know, condensing and downsizing the amount of things that you have. You know, the average person doesn't wear 80% of the clothes that's in their closet already. So as daunting as the task of downsizing somebody's life, as far as the amount of belongings that they have, it's actually quite simple considering the amount of stuff that we don't even use in our everyday lives.
You're absolutely right there. The other thing, too, that has been in the news recently are some cities have started clamping down on tiny homes and where they can be put and adding regulations. I would guess that's a big part of this, too. You've got to find a place to put it.
It is a big part. You know, it's a funny thing. We actually don't have any tiny houses within 500 miles of us. And a lot of the tiny house companies across the country kind of came about based on their markets demanding, hey, we need this product. I found a real passion for it early on when we started the company about two years ago. And but then realized really quickly that we couldn't even operate in our own area. So we actually operate as one of the only tiny house companies as a national brand who really doesn't have anybody living in our homes in our backyard. So it'll be really interesting as we start to see legislation change. And we're already in the ground game of that in both the city of Chicago and outside suburbs. It'll be interesting to see what kind of market share we pick up as soon as we're able to operate within our own backyard.
And this is probably one of the top questions you get too, but where do you go to the bathroom in one of these?
So if you've ever been in an RV, travel trailer, same concept. Okay. As far as traditional plumbing. You have a little regular RV low flush toilet. Or if you've been in a sailboat or any kind of boating bathroom, same kind of setup.
And then the other thing, too, is if we're thinking about doing this, what generally would be the price considerations here? It's sort of, I know a lot of people who I've talked to who would consider this idea think it would be great to sell their home and downsize in terms of price as well. Is it a downsize in terms of price?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, our price, we're actually coming out with a new price point that'll be in the $30,000 range that we're really focusing on. College graduates and those really on a more fixed income basis and really trying to get a leg up on life financially. But our normal typical price points range between 50 and 80,000. Those are our high-end homes, high efficiencies and really nice finishes. But we have a great financing program of 15 years. The average payment on one of our homes is just over $400 a month.
People might ask, too, are these homes, and I'm, again, looking at a lot of your stuff here on your website. I've seen others, too. They look well-constructed. That would be a good question. Are they well-constructed, and are they safe?
Oh, yeah. So our wall system is really it's actually one of the most unique things about our homes, and it kind of sets us apart from the other builders in the industry, in that we use a wall system that's it's steel studs, but it also has polystyrene insulation, which is like, if you've ever used one of those white polystyrene coolers from the gas station, you know how thin that material is, and it holds all that pop and ice and things like that, and they're really strong. Well, our walls are 4 inches thick of that material, so they're incredibly durable. They've been certified by the Florida Dade County Hurricane Commission for a nine seismic rating of 9 on the Richter scale, which I think is one of the highest you can have. They're incredibly well insulated at R30 insulation and 4 inches. And they're just, it's a phenomenal product that really just sets the standard. Also, it creates a very ultralight product. So although we're might be the strongest in our industry, we're also still very light. One of our largest homes, which is 32 feet long and 8 feet wide, comes in at just under 13,000 pounds, where the average home of that size in our industry typically ranges between 18 and 20,000 pounds.
I'm guessing, too, this is this something that gets anchored at some point, or do they stay on the trailers, or is it a mix of both?
Oh, yeah. So the trailers are constructed out of a tubular chassis that they actually are affixed to permanently. And then we have bracket. I don't want to say brackets, but it's called a D-ring. But what it is it's basically just a place where you would hook on a turnbuckle or some sort of tie down that you would then secure to a pylon in the ground. And so they're completely stable as far as hurricanes and tornadoes and things like that. Like, they're not going to just flip over in the middle of the night. They're really solid, and yeah. we engineer it so that they're locked to the ground.
Bob, I'm curious. You've said that most of your business goes elsewhere. Where is this? Where are people living with these homes? Is there a central place that most people go?
I would love for there to be a central place, but right now we've got I think 5 or 6 in California, a handful in Texas, lots of houses in Florida, and then you go up to the New England area, where I think there's 2 for every state up there. Then you go to Ohio, Pennsylvania. I mean, literally, we are all over the map except for Chicago.
Well, Bob, it's good of you to be with us today. Again, we're going to link out some pictures on this. It's very fascinating. I think if I were ever going to do this, I'd maybe go to Wyoming or Montana.
Yeah, you know what? We actually just talked with the Recreation Commission of Wyoming. They have a we might start doing something actually with them, because they have a need for this product for both in their hunting sector and also just their overall camping, to be able to bring these houses out into the middle of nowhere and really just have a nice weekend for people.
Yeah, and I'm guessing, too, this might also at some point be considered as maybe a solution for homeless communities as well.
We're working with the AIA of Chicago. We did a project about 18 months ago with them for that purpose, and now we are working with, and I can't say the name of it, but a very large organization in the city of Chicago, to work with both homeless outreach and also single moms. And so some really good stuff is coming. It's just that it's kind of competitive. Everybody wants to get that first one in Chicago. So we're working with a lot of different groups, and it's really an amazing race to see who pulls it off first.
All right. Bob, best of luck to you and Titan Tiny Homes.
Thank you very much. All right, thanks for having me today.
Bob Clarizio is the president of Titan Tiny Homes. You can find more at titantinyhomes.com, and you can follow them on Twitter as well at Titan Tiny Homes.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
552 on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Dow futures pointing to opening gains on Wall Street later this morning, up 33 points right now. NASDAQ and S&P futures higher as well. NASDAQ futures up about 18 points this morning. Gold and silver also trading higher. Let's get the latest now on commodities and agriculture. And good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Yesterday, soybean futures hit a four-month high. The reason? Weather. Continued worries about stressful crop weather in the Midwest. And also, we do have a report coming out today, the supply-demand report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. August soybeans settled up 4.5 cents at 10.29 1/4 after trading as high as 10.32 1/2, the highest since March 9. September corn ended down 0.25 cents after hitting its highest price since June of 2016. September wheat finished up 3 cents, $5.53 a bushel. Turning to livestock trade yesterday, we got a rally in the live cattle futures thanks to some fund buying, helping both live cattle and feeder cattle futures. August live cattle ended $1.05 higher at $114.87 a hundredweight, and some of that helped, not so much, by cash cattle prices that a week ago sold in the plains from $118 to $119 per hundredweight. As far as lean hog contracts, short covering and discounts to the exchange's hog index for July 7 supported nearby futures. July, which will expire on July 17th, settled 67 cents higher at $92.15 a pound in the lean hog trade yesterday. You have a good day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. Now on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Wednesday, July 12th, 2017. In addition to the Beige Book being released later on today, 1 o'clock Chicago time by the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve Chair herself begins 2 days of testimony before Congress. The House Financial Services Committee will begin the rounds for Janet Yellen. It's the hearing on semi-annual monetary policy, and that will be, again, Janet Yellen in front of Congress. She'll do the Senate side tomorrow. Definitely lots of people in the markets waiting to see what she says, watching what she says to see if it gives any indication of potential a future interest rate hike and monetary policy from the Federal Reserve. OPEC releases its monthly oil market report today. The 25th annual ESPYs Awards ceremony hosted by the NFL quarterback Peyton Manning, Special Olympics founder Eunice Kennedy Shriver will be posthumously honored. That all is later on tonight on, I think, ABC will be hosting that. The House Energy and Oversight Investigation Subcommittee holds a hearing on combating the opioid crisis in the United States. And also today, House Speaker Paul Ryan and others will be meeting with the media to talk about different issues in the Senate. Some of those issues, including the vice president, will focus on health care with a possible vote coming next week, a possible new bill being released tomorrow. It's also Internet Action Day of Action, a group of activists and companies planning an internet-wide day of action to demonstrate against the FCC's plan to repeal net neutrality. Some of the things that could move the markets on this Wednesday, July 12th.